Today is Friday, November the 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Coming up, the Taliban said that they are ready to restart peace talks with the United States a day after President Donald Trump visited U.S. troops in Afghanistan and said that he believed that the group would agree to a ceasefire.
The Taliban wants to make a deal, and we're meeting with them, and we're saying it has to be a ceasefire. They didn't want to do a ceasefire, but now they do want to do a ceasefire. I believe it would probably work out that way.
Also coming up, students around the world are skipping school today, taking to the streets to protest global warming. The stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. The Taliban said that they are ready to restart peace talks with the United States a day after President Donald Trump visited U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Mr. Trump said that he believed that the radical group would agree to a ceasefire in America's longest-running war.
We've been wanting to make a deal, and so have the Taliban, and we pulled back. We were getting close, and we pulled back. We didn't want to do it because of what they did. It was not a good thing they did with killing a soldier. I don't know if they knew he was a soldier, but he was a soldier, an American soldier from Puerto Rico. And he killed him. They killed a United Nations soldier, and they also killed, they killed a total of 12 people. They thought that was good negotiating power. I said, no, that's bad negotiating power. That was not good what they did. And since then, we've hit them so hard, they've never been hit this hard. In the history of the war, they have never been hit this hard. And they want to make a deal. So we'll see what happens. If they make it, fine. If they don't make it, that's fine.
In September, the Trump administration appeared to be on the brink of striking a deal to jumpstart the peace process. But an invitation for Taliban representatives to come to Camp David to cement an agreement was abruptly cancelled. So what is different this time around? For that, I reached VOA journalist Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. How has the news of these renewed talks with the Taliban been received in Afghanistan?
Well, obviously, most of the reaction has been positive because the suspension of the dialogue between the U.S. and Taliban had definitely created uncertainty and more worries for this violence that has been ongoing for the past 18 years. So resumption of the dialogue, not only that people in Afghanistan are looking at it with quite optimism, but even the Taliban, although we are still waiting for an official reaction from the Taliban to the remarks that Trump made. But off the record, I have been able to speak to two Taliban senior officials, and they say that they have, they are ready for re-engaging in the dialogue process with the United States.
What led to the breakdown of the last efforts at the talks? Also, were there any informal talks taking place behind the scenes before President Trump made this announcement?
Yeah, that's right. It is still unclear for many critics and analysts and even for the Taliban that what led to President Trump's decision to suspend the dialogue. But obviously, Trump is keen to pull out American forces from Afghanistan. I mean, that's what it seems from his intentions. But in the last 2 weeks, we know for sure that there have been informal context between Zalmay Khalilzad, who is the chief American peace negotiator, and Taliban negotiators in Qatar. And that dialogue actually, informal context, started for securing the release of this American professor and his Australian colleague in Afghanistan, who had been taken hostage by the Taliban 3 years ago. So that release, a prisoner swap, actually it improved the atmosphere, and that is why it prompted President Trump to make this announcement the other day that his administration has been in contact with the Taliban and that the two sides may be resuming the dialogue, formal dialogue, very soon. So informal contacts have been in place, which shows that both the sides really want to.
There's a goodwill.
There's a goodwill and bring that process back on track as soon as possible.
Now, what do both sides want out of these talks? And what are some of the sticking points that might be of an issue once these talks resume?
Well, the primary issue for the Taliban is that they do not want to speak to the current Afghan government in Kabul because they consider it an illegitimate administration and a product of American occupation of Afghanistan, according to them. So that is where actually both the sides have serious agreement, because the U.S. wants to withdraw its troops under the negotiations that they have held previously, but they also want to make sure that once the foreign forces, including the American forces, withdraw from Afghanistan, the Taliban do not use their military power or military strategy to try to capture or take control of power in Kabul and dismiss or dismantle the system that Americans and other international stakeholders have helped the country put in place, spending billions of dollars and giving freedom of press, ensuring that there's freedom of press in the country, there's freedom for women and other rights and education, all these activities that Taliban, when they were in control of Kabul, had barred. They had barred women from, seeking education and going for outdoor work missions. So I think this is the primary reason that the U.S. does not want to pull out the forces in haste, because there are concerns that Taliban may not abide by its commitments under the agreement that the two sides were about to conclude in September when President Trump suspended that dialogue process.
That was VOA's correspondent in Islamabad, Ayaz Gul. Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi says that he will submit his resignation to the country's parliament after weeks of deadly protests. Abdul Mahdi's announcement comes after Iraq's top Shiite cleric called for a change in leadership in the country. At least 400 people have been killed and hundreds of others wounded since anti-government protests began on October the 1st. VOA's Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch has been covering this story. I reached her in Beirut.
So, Heather, how big is this news that the Iraqi Prime Minister is going to resign?
Well, I mean, it is very big news here, and it certainly will have a large impact in Iraq going forward, but it's not a huge surprise. He had said he would resign if they found someone, and then Ali al-Sistani asked for him to resign, which, of course, is a given. He must resign at that point based on the power that cleric has.
Is this one of the things that the protesters were calling for?
Yes, they're calling for the resignation of a lot of the key leaders in Iraq. But I'm not sure that his resignation will make a huge change in the way the protesters behave, because they say that they want to stay on the streets and continue their demonstrations until they see substantial change in Iraq, in their lives, in the world, not just a different face on the TV.
And what kind of changes are they looking for? What are they calling for?
Well, the main things are really basic things that you would expect in a country as rich as Iraq, with all of this oil, that they would have. As you know, in oil countries, it's often not the case. They don't have regular electricity. They have very poor, poor security. As you know, a huge amount of Iraq just a few years ago was taken over by extremist militants, ISIS. They want jobs. They want education opportunities. They want, for educated people, job opportunities. They want water services and health services and safety from on the streets, from the government, and from militias.
And how has the government responded to their demands?
It seems like the Iraqi government doesn't know what to do. It's very fractured. Like, on one hand, politicians have said, okay, we need to listen to these demands. This is important. The people have spoken, and we're going to reform. The prime minister has said he would resign, and now he has. On the other hand, the military, the Iraqi military is not one thing. It is many things, including militias. Some of the militias are part of the Iraqi government. And some of the security forces have fought back against these protests very violently. Hundreds of people have been killed, while other Iraqi security forces and leaders have said, no, the official government does not harm protesters. So no one really can see at this moment how the Iraqi government is going to manage to get it together to appease the demonstrators.
Now, Heather, we see that some of the protesters have been focusing their anger on Iran and Iranian facilities. Why is Iran the target of the protests?
One thing that makes Iraqis across the board angry is the influence of foreign countries, specifically America and Iran, inside of Iraq and towards their politicians, where a lot of average Iraqis will say, our politicians don't make any decisions. Iran and America make the decisions, and they just do their bidding.
Like the real political control resides in other capital cities, either in Washington, D.C. or in Tehran.
Right. So in terms of the Iranian facilities being bombed, there is a sectarian element in Iraq that's impossible to escape. It's majority Shia, but there's also a large portion of the population is also Sunni Muslim, and they have a history of fighting each other. What's interesting about this, while any Iranian target is definitely a Shia symbol, a lot of the protesters haven't been calling for they've actually been calling for the end of sectarianism, saying that politicians use their religion to make them fight each other. So just because it was an attack on an Iranian embassy, it wouldn't necessarily mean it's a sectarian attack. That has yet to be seen. Because there is anger, even among Shias. I mean, I know Shia people in Baghdad that, you know, are as angry as anyone else about the Iranian and American influence in Iraq.
So there's an element of calling for solidarity within Iraqis themselves in these protests.
Yes, absolutely. Protesters say that fairly uniformly, that they want all of the, because it's not just Shia and Sunni Muslims in Iraq. There's a lot of minorities as well. They want all of these groups to be able to live together and work together as Iraqis, and they blame the political elite for the sectarian fighting amongst themselves. Whether or not this idea of solidarity will turn into a long-term end to sectarianism in Iraq is yet to be seen. I kind of would guess no, but it's the idea now, and it's a good idea. So
that's VOA's Heather Murdock in Beirut. You're listening to International Edition. My name is Jackson Bunganyi. Among the top stories in the world, former Japanese Prime Minister Yoshiro Nakasone, an influential leader in the country's post-World War II politics, has died. He was 101 years old. Mr. Nakasone was a World War II Navy officer who presided over Japan in the 1980s at the pinnacle of its economic success. And students around the world skipped school today and took to the streets to protest global warming. Demonstrations in Madrid, Tokyo, and Melbourne are being billed as Global Day of Action ahead of climate change meetings that begin in Madrid next week. We have expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is asking US President Donald Trump not to get involved in Britain's upcoming election when he visits London for a NATO summit next week. Johnson, an ally of Trump, said that, quote, "What we don't do traditionally as loving allies and friends is get involved in each other's election campaigns." VOA's Henry Ridgewell is in London. I reached him to give us context on the relationship between these two leaders and what prompted Mr. Johnson to make that request. Hello, Henry. Are you on the line with us?
Yeah, good to be with you, Jackson.
How is the relationship between these two leaders, and why is Boris Johnson worried about Mr. Trump's endorsement in the upcoming election?
Well, the background to this is Donald Trump is visiting London next week for a NATO summit, a two-day NATO summit. And, of course, part of that involves doing bilateral meetings and press conferences with different leaders. And one has been scheduled involving Mr. Trump and Mr. Johnson. And while Mr. Johnson is trying to build a good rapport and a good relationship with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has praised Boris Johnson in the past, calling him the exact right guy for the times, Britain faces an election in just 2 weeks' time, and I think Boris Johnson fears that Donald Trump is such a divisive figure that it could put some voters off for voting for his Conservative Party, and secondly, that it could revive fears among some voters about the impact of a potential trade deal between the United Kingdom and the United States after Brexit. The opposition Labour Party have been trying to make a very big point, claiming that the Conservatives are planning to open up Britain's National Health Service to American firms, that prices of medicines could go up. And so Boris Johnson fears that Donald Trump's visit could actually backfire for him.
So what kind of political capital then does Mr. Johnson, who we know that is friends with President Donald Trump, what kind of political capital does he bring to the elections by virtue of his good relationship with the president, the U.S. president?
Well, traditionally, of course, there has always been that special relationship between Britain and the United States. Having a good relationship with an American president is something that is seen generally as a strength for a British prime minister. The United States, of course, remains Europe and Britain's security guarantor. It's the second largest trade partner after the European Union. And, of course, the two countries have always really acted in concert on the world stage, whether you go back to the Iraq war or the war in Afghanistan and so on, they've always been in step. But this is a difficult time for Britain as it leaves the European Union, or as it tries to leave the European Union, because the country is very divided about what future path it should take. Europe remains by far our biggest trading partner. More than half of our goods are sold into the European continent, and if that is going to rupture and change significantly, it could have a big impact on cultural and economic life in the country, and not everybody is happy with that. So Boris Johnson very much wants a very close relationship with America, and especially Donald Trump, and is pushing that. But as we know, you know, half of people, actually just under half, voted to remain in the European Union. So this visit, coming just a week before the general election, is very difficult timing for Boris Johnson, and I think you'll see the opposition parties try to make a lot of political hay from that visit.
And speaking of timing, Henry, students around the world skipped school today in cities like Madrid, in Tokyo, and others are taking to the streets to protest global warming in a sign of how young people are taking this issue seriously. However, in London, Prime Minister Johnson failed to appear in a televised election debate focusing on this issue of climate change. What is Mr. Johnson's stand on this issue, and how is that bound to affect his support among young people? Also, I want you to talk to us first how this played out on TV.
Yes, this was a debate yesterday on television hosted by Channel 4 in the UK, and all the other party leaders except for Boris Johnson, and also except for the Brexit party leader Nigel Farage, turned up to debate this one single issue, what they called the climate emergency. Boris Johnson refused to take part, and instead of his place, the host broadcaster put an ice sculpture, which of course melted away in the television studio in front of everybody else as the others debated this issue. That has prompted a furious response from the Conservative Party, who have accused Channel 4 of being biased, and they've threatened to look at the broadcasting license of Channel 4 if they win the next election. So again, another very divisive issue there, a political party threatening the free media and so on. So it gives you an idea of the anger that's behind this issue. Boris Johnson claims his Conservative Party is taking the climate emergency very, very seriously and has pledged to be carbon neutral within 3 decades. He says they are pushing wind farms and solar power and doing all they can to bring down emissions here in the United Kingdom. But it has to be said, it's not a good look for the leader of the party not to be taking part in this debate.
Right.
And you mentioned the issue of young voters there, and that could, I think, prove a potential surprise in the election. We've had the figures come through for the number of people who have newly registered to vote, and the figure is nearly 2 million. And by far the majority of those are young people under the age of 35 who tend not to vote conservative and who care very much about issues like climate change. All the polls at the moment suggest that the Conservative Party will get a majority and Boris Johnson will remain as Prime Minister. But don't forget, at the last election in 2017, we got a big surprise with a hung parliament. Things like that number of new voters and the young voters could spring us a surprise on December the 12th.
Right. Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us.
A volunteer firefighter in Australia has been accused of arson following an unprecedented bushfire crisis. Dozens of fires continue to burn in the states of Queensland and New South Wales, where more than 50 people have been charged with arson since August. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Fire chiefs say the alleged arson south of Sydney was the ultimate betrayal of emergency crews risking their lives on the front line. They insist the accusations could tarnish the reputation of the entire service. Investigators believe the teenage suspect lit the blazes and then later returned as part of his duties as a volunteer firefighter. The Australian Institute of Criminology has estimated that around half of the nation's bushfires are either arson or suspected arson. Most offenders are male, many are children. Some have been the victims of sexual or physical abuse, while much work has been done to explore the motivations of adult firebugs. Paul Reed is a criminologist from Monash University.
Usually they're marginalised, they're confused. It's thought that they have very low intelligence, but I suspect that that's only because we're catching the ones that have low intelligence. They tend to have deep depression and very socially awkward. They usually have a history of drug use and violence.
Arsonists are responsible for thousands of bushfires in Australia every year, and they can face long jail terms if found guilty. Convictions are rare, though, because evidence is often destroyed by the fire, and there are few, if any, witnesses. Since August, 54 people have been accused of arson in New South Wales state. Another 150 suspects are being interviewed by investigators. More than 2 million hectares of land, including vast areas of forest, have been scorched in eastern Australia's bushfire crisis. Hundreds of homes have been destroyed and 6 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the International Day for the Disabled Persons is commemorated on December 3rd. Disability on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Today is Black Friday. Black Friday, a shopping tradition here in America. But even though people don't celebrate Thanksgiving in countries like France or Russia or South Africa, they do shop on Black Friday. AP correspondent Zaria Sheckley reports.
The U.S. sale phenomenon has spread to retailers across the world in recent years with such force that it's prompting a backlash from some activists, politicians, and even consumers. Near Paris, climate demonstrators blocked a shopping mall and gathered in front of Amazon's headquarters to protest overproduction they say is killing the planet. Workers at Amazon in Germany went on strike for better pay. Some French lawmakers want to ban Black Friday altogether. I'm Zaria Shakili.
We want to thank you for listening to International Edition. For more breaking news, find us at voanews.com. Also, like us on Facebook, VOA Now. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Brown. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington, wishing you a great weekend, everyone.